Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining the call regarding Senate Bill 350, the Clean Energy and Pollution Reduction Act, also referred to as SB 350. My name is Christina Osborne. I work in the Stakeholder Affairs Group at the ISO. Also joining me in the room is Debbie Levine. We do have some speakers on the line who Debbie will introduce in a moment. The purpose of the call today really is informational only. We did post some additional technical material on the Regional Energy Markets webpage, and so we'll talk about that technical material, and it's really just an opportunity for you to ask questions about that documentation. The material is available on the ISO website. If you go to the Stay Informed tab and go down the list, select Regional Energy Markets, you'll see all of the SB 350 information on that page. So what we'll do is we're going to take questions after each section. We'll let you know when we're opening it up for questions. And if you want to ask a question or make a comment, you can enter the queue by pressing pound 2 on your telephone keypad. And we'd just like to remind you to please state your name and affiliation before asking your question. If you have a question or comment for me directly, you can send me a note via the web. You can also email me at kosborne, that's O-S-B-O-R-N-E, at caiso.com. And so with that, I'll go ahead and turn over to Debbie Levine.
Christina, this is Mary Kate. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. We just seem to have had a little glitch that your slides have gone down. So if you could just relaunch your slides, that would be terrific.
Sure. Okay. Bear with us a moment. Yeah, it looks like it stopped sharing the application for whatever reason. Okay, so
it hasn't had its coffee yet.
I know. Either have I. Okay. Now we can see it. Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much, Christina. This is Deb Levine. I'm the Director of Infrastructure Contracts and Management here at the ISO and the Project Manager for SB 350. The reason for today's call is to go through the 9 documents that we put out on March 30th, trying to give stakeholders additional understanding of the details and the technical analysis that we are doing, along with a better understanding of the models. So for today's discussion, we'll have each of our consultants go ahead and go through the documents that were posted. For the Brattle Group, we've got Judy Chang and Hannah Spiefenberger, who will go through the market study analysis that was done, along with where we're at on the production cost analysis. Arnie Olson from E3 will go through a discussion on the Resolve model that we use for the portfolios, along with an update on where we're at with the input data. David Roland Holst will go through there's a few economic models that are used by Berkeley Energy Advising and Berkeley Economics Advising and Research. Sorry, I've got too many energy and economic consultants. And then talk about the disadvantaged communities. And lastly, Brewster Birdsall and Susan Lee with Aspen Environmental will go through their methodology and the disadvantaged community analysis that they're doing. So with that, does anybody have any initial questions before we launch into the discussion?
Again, if you have a question, you can enter the queue by pressing pound 2 on your telephone keypad. I think they're ready to go.
All right. Judy, we'll turn it over to you.
Great. Good morning, everybody. I'm Judy Chang, and with me is Hannah Spiefenberger. We are going to go through the ratepayer impact analysis, starting with the first set of documents in the early release materials that examines and reviews other market integration and regional market studies. Next slide, please.
There's a little delay, Judy, just FYI. There you go.
Okay. As you have seen in the first stakeholder meeting, we had a list of reports and studies conducted by other parties, looking at day-two markets, integration into day-two market, participation into RTOs, these are utilities, evaluating the benefits and costs of joining an existing RTO, We also have a category of studies looking at earlier studies when FERC issued Order 2000 to look at the formation of RTOs. And in the more recent years, the EIM studies conducted across the West. And we also reviewed some European market integration studies. Some of them are looking at how larger footprints could help with the policy objectives in the across Europe. And then the last category is renewable integration studies conducted primarily by NREL and other parties listed in the on the slide that you see here. Next slide, please. I want to get to this next slide because this slide gives us an overview of some of the findings in the market integration studies that we reviewed. And the reason we wanted to have a relatively comprehensive review of what other folks have done and what other markets have analyzed and what their results and findings are is to ensure that we can adopt the best practices in the analytical approach, but also to make sure that our not only the analytical approach makes sense, but also the results that we ultimately will arrive at makes sense in the context of the analyses we're conducting. So I'm going to go through this slide. First, we find that most market integration studies had a production cost simulation and estimated production cost savings, particularly by implementing a day two energy market across a larger footprint, a larger balancing area or a larger footprint. And those production cost savings are roughly between 1 to 3% of the total production cost in the region. And these savings are typically associated with a joint unit commitment and dispatch, a day-ahead dispatch. It also includes, of course, the effect of depancaking transmission charges across larger footprints. There are some of the studies do go into analyzing the savings or potential savings associated with managing uncertainties between the day-ahead and real-time markets or real-time operations. Some of the studies also articulate that regional markets would lead to better utilization of the existing transmission grid. Some studies also identified that they're going into a market or participation in a centralized market provides stronger incentives to increase the efficiency and availability of existing generators. Now, some of these categories of benefits are quantified and some of them are estimated using different methodologies. But what's consistent across most of the studies that we reviewed included a production cost savings analysis, which amounted to 1 to 3% of the total production cost. Now, in addition to production cost savings, some of the markets also analyzed what we call in this SB 350 study the capital cost savings. And those analyses would include reduced generation capacity need in a larger footprint or across a larger footprint, or when a utility is participating or considering participating in a regional market, what their savings would be associated with reduced generation needs. These studies also covered increased access to low-cost renewable generation, which we are also covering in the SB 350 study. Primarily, this means that lower cost renewable might be distant from a particular utility, and participating in a regional market enables the access to those lower cost resources. And then third, there's a reduced cost of balancing. Having a larger footprint and larger market enables the use of more of the existing resources to help balance variable generation on the grid. We also find that there are several prospective studies that emphasize their limitations. And this is important because we're effectively also conducting a prospective study that is using a simulation model that has lots of limitations. Certainly, it's a simulation of what would likely to happen, so many assumptions go into the analyses. And then many of these studies, the prospective studies, do not tend to capture some of the benefits. It tends to overestimate the benefits because many of the assumptions are relatively normalized or averaged, or they're essentially conservative in the way the analyses are conducted. On the other hand, there are several retrospective studies. This means that there are studies conducted after a particular utility joins a market or a market that moves from an imbalanced market into a day two market like SPP. And these retrospective studies tend to document a higher benefit compared to the prospective studies, with results associated with production cost savings in the range of 2 to 8%, whereas before we looked at the prospective studies tend to be 1 to 3% of the total production cost. So through analyzing and reviewing these other studies and comparing across multiple studies, we recognize that there are certain limitations in prospective studies. And I think this is quite important because every step along the way, we are actually trying to be relatively conservative in our assumptions in conducting the SB 350 study, and therefore the results are all tend to be relatively conservative in the benefits that we come up with. Okay, next slide, please.
Judy, the next slide, you go on to the production cost analysis. Would you want to take questions now about the market
study? Sure, that would be great. Sure, that would be great. Thank you.
Great, okay. We actually do have a question in the queue. Just a reminder to please identify yourself before asking your question.
Mary Kay. Hi, this is Susan Snyder from Phoenix Consulting. Can you hear me?
Hi, Susan.
Hi. I just have a really simple clarification question, and I apologize if it's kind of a stupid question, but when you talk about day two markets, would that be to correspond to the ISO's day ahead market, or is there some other meaning to that term?
Yes, that's right. It typically means a market that has two cycles. There's a commitment cycle in the day ahead time, and there's an operating cycle in a real-time market.
Yeah, just to clarify, day two doesn't mean day ahead. It's just that a day two market is a more complete market that includes day ahead markets, real-time markets, congestion, economic security constraint, congestion management, ancillary service markets, e-pancake transmission rates, and so on, compared to a day one market, which might only de-pancake transmission and have an imbalance market. So it basically is a full-fledged RTO market like CalISO versus a, say, EIM-only market.
Okay. Thanks very much for the clarification.
And just a reminder to the speakers as well, if you can identify yourself before answering a question, that would be helpful. So we do have another question in the queue. We'll go ahead and take the question.
Hi, this is Meredith from the CTUC. My question is, and perhaps this is explained somewhere and you can point me towards it, but do any of the other regions that you studied that moved from a, you know, potentially equivalent or state equivalent market to a regional market have similar populations or geographic size to California versus the WEC? Just thinking about the fact that California is already a pretty large actual footprint and population, and obviously moving to a larger western area is a greater in geographic size, but not adding that much in population. So I'm just curious as to what other regions you looked at that might compare to California versus the West. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Hannes Pfeifenberger. Hi, Meredith. as you know, there's no other place like California or the West.
Of course.
But, you know, there are many similarities, and there's smaller regions and larger regions. MISO, for example, has 150,000 megawatts in its footprint, and they grew from a much smaller area. PJM has grown over time. SPP is more the size of California. So there's no other study except for some limited studies in the West that have been done that are quite like California. And, you know, no other market has the amount of hydro resources, for example. But I think there's enough variance in the other markets that were studied to give you a range that should bracket where a regional market in the West should come out.
This is Judy Chang, also with Brattle. Sorry, keep going.
Oh, I was just saying, so MISO expansion might be, you know, the closest example in terms of original size versus expanded size and load and population.
Yeah, MISO is interesting because you had a Entergy footprint that was like 25,000 megawatts, so it's smaller than California, joining MISO, which is larger. I mean, populations, there's nothing that's quite comparable, but we do see that, what we find is that the size of the studies documented are not really very dependent on the size of the market or the type of the market or the population. It's in some ways how many balancing areas you're consolidating, the general benefit of a more efficient congestion management in a day two market. And so while none of the other studies by themselves are perfectly comparable, I think there are enough similarities and there's enough variance. In addition, of course, we have reviewed some studies like the renewable integration studies that are specifically for the WEC, and there's a lot that can be learned from that as well.
This is Judy. I also just want to add that in some ways, the other studies are typically from the perspective of two different perspectives, either from the perspective of the joiner, so it's either a utility or groups of utilities considering joining a RTO that's already formed that has a quite large footprint with diverse population locations, or it's from the perspective of a market that's already formed but transitioning from a imbalanced market to a regional, what we call day two market. So it's true that it's not directly comparable, but it is also true that some of these studies really cover the various different perspectives of participating in a market that's already formed.
Right.
So in some ways, it's very comparable in the sense the SB 350 study is, it's enlarging the market, but it's also from the perspective, it could also be seen as from the perspective of the other states that might be joining.
And each of the studies sort of had a valuable perspective on what creates benefits, even if the size of the benefit might vary. For instance, WAPA and Basin joining SPP in the Eastern Interconnection, WAPA in the East looks a lot like WAPA in the West. It's hydro resources, far-flung service area, not a lot of load, a lot of transmission, whereas SPP, looks a lot like CalISO with a day two market now and so on. SPP is also interesting because they went from a energy imbalance market to a day two market. So the SPP experience is interesting because it shows you what a region gains from going beyond an energy imbalance market. And of course, none of these studies are relied on to say this will be the benefit in the West, but I think it gives you a perspective and a sort of reasonableness check of where our study comes out.
Thank you again. I'll be muted again. Thank you.
Okay, Mary Kate, we'll take the next question.
Hello, my name is Sean Neal on behalf of Modesto, Santa Clara, and Redding. My question goes to the previous slide, and I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the incentives to act or operate more efficiently, if you could provide some examples of that just to help us better understand the issue.
Yes. I mean, obviously, this wouldn't apply to generators that are already within California ISO because that is already there have been some studies that have investigated of how being part of the market has joined or has affected the how, say, coal plants and natural gas plants are operated, how they're maintained, and there are some studies that have found, for example, that being part of a transparent price signal that gives you hour-by-hour LMPs that dispatches you less, if you're slightly less efficient than your next-door competitor, has led over time to efficiency improvements and availability improvements at power plants. And one of the studies that we've summarized in the pre-release document, for example, found that, the operating cost of power plants in a restructured market environment has improved by about 2 percentage points. There are also some reviews of availability within RTO regions that shows that plant availability has trended upwards after a company joined an RTO, and it's attributed to the improved pricing and dispatch transparency that you see in a day two market.
Thank you.
Great. All right, Mary Kate, are there any other questions?
Yes, we have two other callers waiting to ask a question. Doug Larson, please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Doug Larson, DL Energy. Will the SB 350 study results have any qualitative or quantitative discussion of the size of the benefits that result from the size of the unaccounted for benefits that result from the use of conservative assumptions?
Yes. I think we will likely that there will be a qualitative discussion of benefits not quantified, and I think a comparison with the sizes of benefits in retroactive studies that have been documented in retroactive studies would probably give us a sense of the magnitude of the benefits not quantified. There will also be some benefits that we will not quantify within the scope of the study that have been quantified by other studies. So there will be some cross-referencing of that going on.
Just to be clear, this is Judy Chang again. Just to be clear, we are estimating the production cost savings across WEC in the study. We are going to conduct a ratepayer impact, which is a quantifiable estimate, which ratepayer impact analysis will include the estimated value associated with both operational cost savings and capital cost savings. as well as we will also be analyzing the environmental impact, disadvantaged community impact, and economic impact. What we will also talk about is, having done all of these analyses, the assumptions that we've used, and we will also identify which assumptions we think are relatively conservative in coming up with benefits of the regional markets. And then we will also discuss qualitatively the type of benefits that are not yet included in all of the above.
Yeah, lastly, maybe to add, we will not just provide you with a point estimate and say, here's the impact, but there will be ranges that are somewhat dependent on the conservativeness of the assumptions. So, for instance, one assumption might be, by 2030, will California be needing new capacity, or will it still be long of capacity? So there might be a range for capacity cost savings that says, well, if there's excess capacity, the value of the capacity cost savings will be relatively low. If there's a need for new capacity, the benefit will be higher. So there will be a range that relates to just how or less conservative you want to be on some of the assumptions.
Thank you. That'll be very helpful.
And we do have another person waiting to ask a question. Antonio, can you please press #2 on your phone so that I can identify your line? Thank you. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Antonio Alvarez with PG&E. I do have two questions also related to the findings page of other studies. I'm curious whether there is anything related to impacts on market prices, or whether we should expect a change in market prices similar to the 1 to 3% reduction in production costs. In particular, when you have different areas, some are selling, some are buying, if there's anything that can be extracted from prior studies about the impacts on buying and selling areas in terms of prices.
Well, in other studies, there are also, aside from production cost savings, some of the studies do carry those analyses into adjusted production cost analyses, and some of the studies might look at the impact on customers' costs, which will reflect the wholesale market impact on wholesale market prices. For the SB 350 study, where prices come in is in the ratepayer impact, where we will take the California perspective only, because that's a requirement on the SB 350 study scope, from the California ratepayer, and that's all of California, just to answer some of the stakeholders' questions about whether it's only CAISO or all of California's, ratepayer perspective. What the purchase power and the price at which power will be sold, those impacts will be reflected in the ratepayer impact.
Okay. So you'll be looking at the impact on market prices associated with the expansion?
Yes, we will calculate how, if you have to buy power, how the quantity and the price of power purchases change, I mean spot purchases. We will also estimate how, if when you're selling in the market, how the quantity and price of your sales will change.
Okay, great. And the other question I had is related to the savings related to capacity. Since there is no plans to look at loss of load expectation before and after, is there anything the other studies look at that? I mean, in the part that I'm curious is loss of load events that occur in one area tend to be, when you do the reliability simulation, tend to show up as an effect on the aggregate area. And I'm just I'm not sure if there's anything that can be said about whether loss of load expectations is likely to increase or decrease as a function of the expansion in the prior study.
Antonio, the way we're looking at this, we're looking at load diversity.
Right.
You know, like MISO, when MISO and Entergy integrated, the reserve margin that Entergy needed to hold as a percentage of its own peak load decreased because Entergy's coincident peak load with the MISO system decreased. So we will do a detailed WECC-wide load diversity study taking into account how much people are already taking advantage of load diversity and then estimate by how much, say, California can reduce its generation need by virtue of having a coincident peak load that's slightly less than its own peak load.
Yeah, but that assumes the same
margin. Antonio, what was that?
But that assumes the same planning reserve margin, so it's the planning reserve margin doesn't change. But what I was curious is whether, because of the loss, if the loss of load were to increase, that would mean I need a slightly higher margin to take care of the larger area that where some of the outages associated with one area can be taken care of by the integration or the expansion of the RTO.
Yeah, we're capturing we're not doing our own loss of load probability study, but WECC has done some work in this area where they estimated the planning reserve margin needed for a larger subregion. Mm-hmm. And what you can see is that the utilities within a subregion might have planning reserves that are less than the subregion as a whole needs, because they can take advantage of exchanges, whereas the subregion as a whole is more limited in how much they can exchange with neighbors. But that kind of dynamic is reflected in our analysis, and we do rely on in part on the WECC subregional LOLE analysis that they did to come up with a proxy reserve margin for each of the larger WECC subregions.
Okay. Thank you.
Mary Kate, any other questions?
At this time, Christina, there are no additional questions.
Okay. Perfect. Judy, do you want to continue on with the production cost analysis slides?
Please.
Slide 7, Judy?
6.
Slide 6.
Oh, okay. There you go.
What the next two slides are the assumptions that we're using, the key assumptions we're using for the production cost analysis for both the 2020 and the 2030. This first slide, slide 6, has a table that looks at, in 2020, under current practice, what are the assumptions we have, and then under 2020 regional case, what assumptions we have. Just generally, given the feedback, in case some folks on the phone was not aware, given the feedback we received since the first stakeholder meeting, we have adjusted the study scope so that the 2020 regional case will include only the ISO and PacifiCorp. And then for the 2030 regional case, we'll include the ISO and all the rest of WECC without except the PMAs. And I'll talk more about it on slide 7. But on slide 6, I just want to go over it briefly, which is the renewable portfolios, which you will be we had discussed that in the first stakeholder presentation, but we'll talk about that again when E3 gets on the phone here. The transmission topology we adopted from what ISO's existing grid view model had and all the existing assumptions. For the 2020 current practice, oh, actually for both the 2020 case, we've also removed any transmission projects that were not going to be installed by 2020, were assumed to not be installed by 2020. Also based on feedback from stakeholders, the load, gas prices, and the greenhouse gas carbon prices in California, we are now basing all of them on the 2015 IPER, the data in the 2015 IPER. For 2020, we are assuming a zero carbon price outside of California in the rest of WECC. For reserve requirements, we have updated the model to assume that frequency response, load following, and regulation will be deployed from a balancing area to balancing area. And then in the 2020 regional case, with ISO and PacifiCorp joined, there will be allowed sharing in the joint balancing area. In the 2020 case, we also have assumed a export limit. We actually are doing two different scenarios with the export limits. Under the current practice, there's a export limit of zero. And then, under 2030, we have two different scenarios. For 2020, we assume the under current practice is 0 megawatt of export limits. And under the regional case, though, because of the integration of ISO and PacifiCorp, we use the contract path of 776 megawatts. For the hurdle rate, under current practice, we included a hurdle rate between every balancing area that incorporates the wheeling cost based on recent transmission tariff, an administrative charge, and a hurdle rate that reflects the friction of trade between the balancing areas. And then the contract path, all the contract paths between PacifiCorp East and West are not subject to the hurdle rate I just described. And then also under the regional case, the hurdle is removed between the ISO and the PacifiCorp balancing areas. We also refined, I'm just looking at the text, we have also refined the modeling of pump storage, hydro, and some of the unit's characteristics in the traditional grid view model that was based on the TEPC database. Okay, next slide, please. Slide 7 covers the same information for the 2030 current practice and 2030 regional case. Something, instead of me going through all of the table boxes in the table, I just want to highlight a few things. Most of the information I've reflected before. I think that the major difference is in 2030, the next export limits we are testing for the current practice of 2,000 and 8,000 megawatts. And under the regional case, we're leaving that at 8,000 megawatts. By doing so, you will be able to see results that just reflect the changes, or that reflect both the changes of increasing the ability to be able to export and trade across the seam with from ISO with the rest of the WECC, and through this network net export limits. In addition, we also, for Regional 3 case, we did reflect in the transmission topology an addition of transmission. We use PacifiCorp's gateway D and segments D and F to represent a generic transmission solution to deliver the Wyoming wind that's reflected in the portfolio under the regional case in the regional case 3. And we'll go back again to the regional cases in E3's presentation. But what we have done in the regional case for transmission topology is to increase the transmission capability to allow the disbursement, essentially, of the wind in Wyoming. And similarly for New Mexico, we're doing the same thing on the solar and wind capabilities in New Mexico, from New Mexico. Similar to 2020-2030's cases also do not have a carbon price for rest of WECC. However, we are also going to conduct a sensitivity analysis with a carbon price in rest of WECC as requested by many stakeholders through the stakeholder comments. That's what I have for 2030 and 2020 assumptions. I see many hands raised, and so we can open that up for questions, please.
Great. Thank you, Judy. So, Mary Kate, we'll take the first question. Just a reminder to identify yourself before asking your question.
Hi, this is Paul Nelson from Southern California. And can people hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you, Paul.
Okay. I've got two questions. One is going back to the 2020 assumptions, and I believe you said that the 22 regional, you said you had deep, that the rates were unpancaked or de-pancaked. Is that correct?
It's only de-pancaked for the ISO to PacifiCorp path of 776 megawatts.
Oh, okay. So I was a bit confused because the table says same as current practice, which would imply pancaked rates. So you only did
We should be more clear about that. It remains pancaked for the rest of WECC and across balancing areas across the WECC.
Okay.
The only piece that's de-pancaked is between PacifiCorp and ISO because under Regional 2020, we're only assuming regional ISO and the PacifiCorp balancing areas.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you for that clarification. And my second question is, I'm trying to understand how these assumptions, the assumptions on slides 6 and 7 for 2020 and 2030 fit into the three scenarios that are on E3's presentation.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Even as I presented it, I realized that's the case. So in E3's presentation at the first stakeholder meeting and updated today or in the early release material, has scenarios of portfolios. Effectively, the easiest way to think about it is portfolios 1 are under current practice, simulated as for the production cost simulation, we're simulating under current practice with those portfolios. And scenarios 2 and 3 are effectively regional practice or regionalized, and we use those portfolios for 2030 regional cases.
So for 2030, you will see 4 cases. You will see 2 current practices cases with 1A and 1B portfolios, and you will see 2 regional cases with the Scenario 2 and Scenario 3 portfolios.
Okay, that's helpful.
All right, we'll move on to our next question. Fred, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, it's Fred here at Northwest Energy Coalition. I hope you can hear me. I've got 2 questions. The first one is I just missed a couple words. I think in the referring to the 2020 phase, you mentioned PMAs. I presume it's power marketing authorities. I wonder if you could make that statement again.
Yes, that's right. Under In 2030, the regional case, it's actually slide 7, please.
Thank you.
Under the regional case, it's the WEC, across WEC minus without the public marketing authorities.
So it's a hypothetical.
This is Deb Levine. Just to be very, very clear, it's the WEC minus the balancing authority areas that are currently power marketing administrations.
Deb, this is Arnie Olson. It's the U.S. portion of the WEC.
Thank you, yes. I forget
that. Just to be very, very clear.
Very, very clear.
All right. This is Fred again. So I guess maybe I was a little confused because my understanding was that the general study area would be the entire U.S. portion of WEC, including all BAs, but maybe I didn't get that right.
Yeah, actually, let me make that even clearer. We are studying the entire WEC. The study analyses and the model used has the entire WEC in it. All we're saying is for the regional case, we are including a market structure across the entire WEC without BPA and without WAPA.
Being part of the RTO footprint, and that was the feedback we got at the stakeholder meeting. At the stakeholder meeting, and that's probably what you remember, we wanted to study the entire U.S. WEC as a regional market, and the feedback we got from numerous entities was that that was too aggressive an assumption, so we changed the 2020 assumption to only ISO and Pacific Core, and we created a larger hypothetical footprint for 2030.
Well, I guess my response to that is it's a useful look, but I think it would also be useful to see what would happen with the in the 2030 case, the analysis, what it would look like if all of the West was included, including the PMA areas, which are, you know, speaking from the Northwest, obviously it's a Bonneville Power Administration has about 75% of our transmission, so it's a very significant factor. So, let me move on to my next question, which is on the 2030. You mentioned that you're including Pacific Core Gateway segments D and F, and you said that that would help disperse the wind in Wyoming. My question is, in this analysis, does any of that wind reach California, or is the dispersal only within the Pacific Core footprint?
The way to think about this is we are assuming a portfolio in Scenario 3 that includes more wind in Wyoming and more wind in New Mexico, and to ensure that the system actually can balance, we needed to assume some transmission additions. And we've used some of the transmission that's already in the study phases as a generic solution to do that. But there is no because it's a regional market simulation, we're actually not assuming that all of that power needs to be delivered to California.
Yeah, let me add to this a little bit. In the current practice case, we do assume that renewables located outside of California, outside the CAISO balancing area, would be dynamically scheduled into CAISO, so would actually be physically delivered in CAISO. In a regional market, you don't have a concept of physical delivery within the market. Every generating resource is just injecting into the market, and every load is taken out of the market. So in scenarios 2 and 3, there is no physical delivery to any locations within the market. It's just physical transactions between the market and any neighboring areas. Under the current practice, however, any out-of-state resources, with exception of REC resources, are physically scheduled into the CAISO balancing area.
Okay, thanks for that. Those are my questions. I would just observe on that since we're in the context of SB 350 and the California 50% RPS, I think that point will get further discussion. Thanks.
Great, thank you.
Okay, moving on to our next question. Ezra, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hey there. I have two questions. My first relates to slide six. Actually, the questions are kind of related. On slide six, the question, can you hear me? Yes, apparently. The ISO export limit. I'm trying to understand, A, why the export limit is zero in the current practice case and why it is constrained by a contract path in the regional case, which presumably is, you know, the whole point is getting rid of contract paths. And the second question actually is on slide seven, which has to do with Gateway's DNF and why that assumption is predicated on the regional market as opposed to just existing practice. Thank you. I meant to identify myself. It's Ezra Hausman working with Sierra Club.
Hi, Ezra. This is Hannes Pfeffenberger. Couple answers to the several questions that you had. The contract path question in 2020, that is there because we only have Kalaisu and Pacific Core that are interconnected by a contract path of 776 megawatt one direction and a little bit more the other. So the regional there's not that much of a regional market. The only regional market is Pacific Core appended to Kalaisu with a contract path. That's why we have a contract path. The zero, the question in the current practice cases is how much do we reasonably assume could bilateral markets accomplish in selling off California resources if there are excess generation conditions. And as you may know, currently California never reaches net export limits. California is always net importer. And we have, even in 2020, we have about 4,000 megawatts of average import into the state. So if you have a 4,000 megawatt import into the state to get to a net zero export limit, you would actually have to sell off all 4,000 megawatts that you currently bring in on the contracts or dynamically scheduled back out into the West. And that zero export limit is a limit that has been modeled in various other settings for LTPP and so on, and we've maintained that for the 2020 case. In the 2030 cases, we relax that export limit, even under the current practices, to particularly in case 1B, by an extra 6,000 megawatts. So once you get to scenario 1B in 2030, we assume that bilateral markets would be able to sell off everything that's brought in, plus an additional 6,000 megawatts.
I see. So should the combined, should the export limit in the regional cases be interpreted as export from the larger regional ISO? So it's really looking at a different number.
In the regional cases, in the two regional cases, scenarios two and scenario three, we assume a physical path rating for exports out of Kalaisu of 8,000 megawatts. As you know, many of the paths do not even have a rating going the other way. They only have import ratings. So we don't know, without doing a path rating study, what the simultaneous export capability out of California might be, since we've never even approached a net zero export. So in scenarios two and three, we assumed that the simultaneous export limit would be 8,000 out of the Kalaisu footprint, and that is sort of consistent with what we think bilateral markets could accomplish in scenario 1B.
But I think your question reflects that it's really just the export limit we're showing on the table from California out. It's not whatever the footprint would be under regional case. So I think I take your point, but really that should say California next export, not the ISO's net export.
Right.
Right. It's the net export out of the out of today's CalISO footprint. That is a clarification we will need to add.
Thank you. And the other question was about, on this slide, the Pacific Core Gateway DNF to represent transmission, why that would be dependent upon the regional market as opposed to something that would be equally available either under current practice or regionalization.
Well, that's, of course, a very good and very important question. The portfolios in the current practice cases rely to some extent on external resources, but have assumed to be limited to what the current transmission system can accommodate on a just energy basis. In scenario three, we open up the California rules so that California state rules would allow to be more resources be placed outside, and the model places several thousand megawatts into Wyoming, and we assume that, not that much renewables can be accommodated in Wyoming without some sort of transmission upgrade. And the E3 can talk about it more. The assumption is that California would have to pay for that transmission upgrade. So a particular project might be built in any case. We just assume the incremental cost to California would include transmission that is needed to integrate that substantial amount of renewables in the Wyoming area or in New Mexico.
Thank you.
All right, Mary Kate, I understand we have more questions.
We do. I'll move on to the next person. Nancy, please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Nancy Kelly with Western Resource Advocates, and I have a question on slide 6 regarding the hurdle rate in 2020.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was waiting for it to switch so I could see it. So,
there's a delay in the web. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. So, it shows that there is no hurdle rate between Pacific Core's east and west balancing areas in 2020, but therefore it appears that there is a hurdle rate between Pacific Core's balancing areas in the CAISO in 2020, and then that is removed from the current practice. And my question is about the existence of that hurdle rate in current practice given the EIM. And I was wondering if you could address the assumption of a hurdle rate under current practice in 2020.
Yes. As you may know, the amount of transmission that's available to EIM is quite limited. So any bilateral transactions on a day-ahead basis or even intraday until you get to the EIM timeframe will have to pay for transmission. And that's what we are modeling. We are basically modeling the transactions that would happen or likely happen on a day-ahead basis. And despite the fact that EIM is able to use some of the transmission in that EIM timeframe on a day-ahead basis, when a day-ahead trades and for purpose of unit commitment and so on, those transmission costs would be incurred.
I see. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Next question is from Susan. Susan, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Oh, hi. This is Susan Schneider, Phoenix Consulting. I had three, but I hope are pretty quick questions. The way I had a question on slide 6 on the ISO net export limit of zero. So the way I understand it is in order to get to zero by 2020, we would have to, the ISO area as a whole would have to start exporting gross exports of somewhere around 4,000 megawatts just to get to zero. Is that right?
Yes.
Did I understand that? Okay.
Well, hold on. But the export limit here, it just says that we're limiting how the current CAISO's footprint is able to export power, net export power. That's all that means. It doesn't mean that we don't allow them to export anything. Does that make sense?
Not really.
I think you had it. We're net importers of 4,000 megawatts.
Right.
Or we're importing 4,000 megawatts. We allow the model to re-export that entire amount before it gets to zero.
Okay, so you're allowing the model to do that, but you're not assuming that will actually happen necessarily. That's going to be determined by the model output.
Exactly. It's the economic decision.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. A couple of other questions. The New Mexico generic, and this is now on slide 7, sorry, the generic transmission for New Mexico solar, can you just discuss that for a second, where you got that from or what you're assuming there? It sounds like you had the gateway as sort of a basis for the Wyoming transmission, but what are you assuming for New Mexico?
We will have to get back to you on that. I don't recall exactly what.
Okay.
Hannes, this is Arnie Olson from E3. I can probably take that one. This is one of the things that I was going to talk about when I get to my presentation, but one of the things we've done since the February stakeholder meeting is gone back and refined our estimates of the transmission costs for getting this out-of-state wind in New Mexico and Wyoming. So for Wyoming, we've used the Gateway DNF projects as really just a proxy for some transmission that we think would need to be built in the Wyoming area. It's not meant to be an endorsement of any particular line, but it lines up actually quite well with the assumptions that are in the PacifiCorp IRP that says the Gateway projects, they're not sure if they can build them just on their own. They might need help. And together they would deliver about 3,000 megawatts of Wyoming wind, which is roughly what we were assuming was available. In the New Mexico case, we've modeled two tranches, one that's 1,500 megawatts to get from the New Mexico wind areas into the Four Corners area. We assume it could be delivered over existing transmission from there. Then there's a second tranche, which is represented by a new corridor along the southern part of Arizona, roughly equivalent to the SunZia corridor, and we've used the SunZia costs to reflect the transmission build that might be required to deliver that wind. And so again, these are proxy, just to give us some transmission costs to assign to those resources so that we weren't assuming we could deliver them for free without any investment.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. I had a question about the hurdle rates. You have different charges there, and then you have something called friction. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, that's basically a bilateral trading margin that people need to accomplish before they make a trade. So people just wouldn't make a trade unless they make at least a dollar a megawatt hour.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, and then just one last question. The 8,000 megawatts for the ISO net export limit, so you're assuming with regionalization the ISO would, and this is California, would be able to export up to 8,000 megawatts with regionalization. You're assuming that basically if you go with regionalization there's barriers or basically because you're going to be using all the same dispatch that somehow those, I'm trying to understand why the limits would be higher. You wouldn't be looking at, say, the 2,000, that somehow the regionalization in and of itself would allow California to export more. Is that because,
we
talked about before, the whole day-ahead framework allows more facilitating those exports?
Well, in Region 2 and 3, it's more a physical limit. As I said before, right now, there many of the paths into and out of CAISO have an import rating but don't have an export rating.
So we don't know exactly, if we did a path rating study, what the simultaneous export limit would be on the physical transmission system. So we assume that would be 8,000 megawatts, which would allow us to swing from today a 4,000 megawatt import to a 8,000 megawatt export. So it would allow power flows to reverse by a magnitude of 12,000 megawatts. It might be that the physical limit is larger than that, but that's just not known at this point.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's all the questions I had.
Okay. Moving to our next person. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi. This is Neil Reardon of the California PUC. Others have asked my questions, so nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we'll go to our next person, John Newton. John, your line is open.
Hello, this is John Newton from PG&E. I had a clarification question with regard to some of the assumptions that are going into the AHT cost for 2020. So I understand that there are several prices included in the IPER. Can you hear me?
Yeah, John, somebody's line is open. I'm not sure if it's one of the speakers, so if you could just manually mute it so we can hear John's question, that'd be helpful.
Sure. David, I think it's from you. I'm going to mute your line for now.
Great, thank you.
Great.
Sorry, go ahead, John.
Yeah, so with regard to the GHG price assumptions, I understand that there are several prices included in the IPER. It would be helpful to understand with a little bit more specificity where that is coming from, just since there are several sources.
Yeah, we use the midpoint estimate in the IPER.
Great. Thank you. That's all.
All right.
Thank you.
Next question is from Kevin Woodruff. Kevin, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Kevin Woodruff, consultant for TURN. I had to take a quick call, so I may have missed this. I have two topics. The first one I think is pretty simple, but going back to the wheeling rate, the admin charges and friction, is that basically you use the number of dollars per megawatt hour, $1 per megawatt hour. Is that basically what your hurdle rate is wheeling rate or the tariff wheeling rate plus a dollar a megawatt hour?
There's the wheeling rate itself, like the California tax.
Right.
Then there is, you pay more than just wheeling. You pay administrative charges, like the GMC charges. So we looked at various utilities, and the administrative charges that are on top of the wheeling rate itself is about a dollar.
Okay.
And then we also, in the sort of intraday trading, we also assume that bilateral trades wouldn't happen until there's at least $1 of additional trading margin. So it's a wheeling rate, the administrative charge, and a dollar trading margin that needs to be covered before the bilateral trade occurs.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. I'm taking notes here. The administrative charges, though, those vary by the utility along with the wheeling rates?
The wheeling rates vary by utility. The administrative charges, we looked at several utilities, and they were all around a dollar. So we used a dollar as a generic estimate.
Okay, so it's tariff wheeling charge plus $2 a megawatt hour, basically.
Yes, for the intraday trade. For purpose of changing unit commitment, we have wheeling rate plus a dollar plus $4 because, as you may know, people are more hesitant to change unit commitment than to make intraday trades around committed units.
Okay, so that's the friction charge is $4 per megawatt hour?
Yes.
When you're doing commitment.
When you do unit commitment, there's a $4 friction charge for intraday dispatch. There's only a $1 friction charge on top of the wheeling rate and the administrative charge.
Okay. Thank you. Now, do you keep track of all the flows out of the ISO in your modeling?
Yes, both physical and contractually.
Contractual, okay, and you could estimate sort of what the, so it's fairly straightforward to take those, some of those quantities, multiply them by the, like the wheeling rate and see what sort of like, quote, wheeling out revenues might be, for example.
Yes, that can be calculated for the treatment of existing transmission costs. We are assuming that on average existing transmission costs would be recovered as they are today. So California in actuality may lose wheel out revenues, but at the same time does not have to pay wheeling in charges. But ultimately, how that is all shared depends on what the regional TAC will look like. And so in our analysis, we assume that the regional TAC would be negotiated in such a way that the existing transmission costs, as they are, so the net transmission revenue requirements that California ISO customers are paying today would remain unchanged as it relates to the existing transmission costs.
I'm sorry, could you run that last sentence again?
We assume that the interaction between losing wheel out revenues, avoiding wheel in costs, and sharing transmission revenue requirements in a regional TAC would be negotiated between the various parties joining the region such that everybody keeps paying today's net revenue requirements for the existing transmission. So there wouldn't be a windfall simply by virtue of not having to pay for wheel-in costs.
That's, I mean, that sounds like a simplifying assumption, which I understand. But you're not.
Yes.
My main question is that we could pull out data to look at what the implications are for recovery of current transmission revenue requirements.
Yes, including any transmission costs that he would avoid by not having to pay for wheeling in.
Yeah, understood. So, okay. First question. Next question is, you talk about, renewables being delivered, might say to the sort of, ISO-wide load and not to California in particular. How are you modeling potential local generation constraints within California?
Well, we have all the transmission constraints and contingency constraints modeled that are in the CalISO's grid view model for transmission planning. So all the path ratings are modeled and all contingency constraints are modeled and enforced.
Okay, and does that automatically sort of covers some of like the local generation requirements that may or may not exist?
We're also enforcing some must-run units and some frequency response constraints and load following requirements and so on. So I think it's a very detailed and accurate representation of the actual operational environment, yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay,
we're
on to Carl.
Yeah, just before you turn it over to Carl, we are going to take one more question. We're kind of running a little bit behind, so we know there's some folks still in the queue, but we want to hear your questions. So if you could submit those in writing instead, we'll make sure that we address those. But you could submit those to the regionalintegration@caiso.com mailbox, and we'll make sure we get to your questions. But we apologize, but we do need to move on. So go ahead and open up Carl's line.
Hi, thank you. I'll be brief. On slide 7, the assumptions about GHG pricing, there we go. It looks like nothing outside California was modeled. I just wanted to point out WEC does model a carbon price outside or WEC-wide. It was established, I believe, for the 2034 case. It's something like $52 a ton, something like that. I don't know exactly. I don't have it in front of me, but it should be easy to do. And being WEC is already using that carbon price, they did a survey of a variety of different carbon studies, and as they looked out ahead, that was sort of around, not the midpoint, but the a realistic estimate of what we might be looking at. So I just wanted to point that out in case that you wanted to have a value or a sensitivity that had a value for a carbon price WEC-wide. There is an assumption that there will be some related to existing and expected regulation. That's
just,
all.
Just to clarify, the WEC common case does not include that, but you are referring to the carbon case that WEC is running. So we'll have a look at that.
And as I said earlier, we are conducting a sensitivity around the carbon price outside of California.
Okay. You may want to look at what TEPSI came up with. Jamie Austin of PacifiCorp helped lead that group inside TEPSI that did that analysis. And I believe E3 also had done a previous analysis of carbon pricing, existing assumptions that utilities were using around the West. And I believe that one is around 30, and Arnie can probably tell me, something like $30 a ton.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Carl. So we are going to go ahead and move on so that we can, you know, we have until noon, but we have quite a bit more material to cover. So, Arnie, we'll go ahead and turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, this is Arnie Olson. I'm a partner with E3, and I have with me to answer all the hard technical questions Anna Maleva, who's a senior consultant at E3 and was leading most of the modeling work. Because there was a lot of material presented at the February 8th workshop, some of which has been kind of reposted online with some of the updates. I only have just a couple of slides to go over to highlight. First of all, just to kind of remind everyone about the modeling tool that we're using and the sort of the methodology and the logic that it uses to develop the portfolios. And then one slide just to quickly highlight some of the changes that we made in response to the stakeholder comments. So if we can go to the next slide. So We posit, I guess, that regional integration might have two potential impacts that could affect the type and the cost of renewable energy that California procures to meet its 50% RPS by 2030. Now, the first of these effects is that having a larger regional market to operate the system over can help relieve the renewable integration challenges that we expect to see at such a high level of renewable penetration. It can help to find markets for surplus, largely solar energy that California can't use during the daytime hours, particularly in the springtime. And so just by expanding the size of the operational footprint, we think this would reduce the cost of achieving a 50% RPS in California and potentially change the portfolio, because doing that would make solar relatively more valuable in California than other resources by having a more diverse grid. So in that sense, we might expect that the regional integration could help improve the economics of both central station and rooftop solar in California. The second effect is, and this we model this separately because we want to understand what the relative magnitude is of these two separate effects. The second effect is that by expanding the area over which California entities can procure renewable energy, expanding the size of the supply curve, it makes available larger quantities of very high-quality out-of-state resources, and in particular, high-quality wind in Wyoming and New Mexico. So our scenario two that Hannes and Judy talked about is meant to represent that first impact of regional integration of just operations. Scenario three, then, we look at the effect of procuring over a broader footprint and having better access to higher quality wind resources outside of California. So the tools that we use to develop the portfolios under sort of all four of our cases, 1A, 1B, 2, and 3, is the Renewable Energy Solutions Model. It's a model that was developed at E3 to put together least cost portfolios of renewable energy and renewable energy integration solutions to meet any specific RPS target. So what the model does is it's a linear optimization. It minimizes the sum of operating costs and investment costs over a fixed time period. In this case, we're modeling the time period between 2015 and 2030. It has available to it supply information that California has developed in various proceedings over the years, starting with READY back in 2008, 2009, and those assumptions have been updated numerous times. And the most recently in version 6 of the RPS calculator. So we start with all of that data on the supply of renewables. So we have wind and geothermal and solar in-state, out-of-state, variety of different configurations. We have some out-of-state resources in there as well. It selects the least cost combination of wind and solar and geothermal in-state, out-of-state. And we find that as we get closer and closer to a 50% RPS, and this is particularly true under the kind of California-only procurement case, that we really need to factor in the impact of the solutions that are available, because they do have a big impact on the portfolio. And particularly in some of our cases, we're seeing energy storage that the model wants to add on an economic basis that helps to improve the economics of solar energy in California relative to the other types. So if we don't include the effect of those solutions, when you get above kind of 45% RPS or so, then we're missing a part of the picture. So that's why we developed this model, and that's why we're using this model in this case. So renewables are added to meet the RPS target, and if necessary, the model will overbuild the renewable portfolio, and this is important. Because this actually ends up being a pretty big chunk of the savings, is that we treat the RPS as a hard constraint. So if there are renewables that can't be delivered to California load, then the model has to add more renewables so that the amount of delivered energy is equal to 50% of the retail sales. So sometimes we might have curtailment due to overgeneration, and the model deals with that by building more. And so you see the effect of that in the total capital cost, which is then subsequently borne by California ratepayers in the form of PPAs or renewable contracts. So in that sense, we treat all contracts that are signed as kind of sunk costs, and the cost of curtailment is really the cost of overbuilding. I think I'll stop there. I was going to mention the transmission piece at this point as well, but I think I already did that. So I think I'll stop here to ask if there are any questions about kind of the methodology, what the Resolve model does, how we go about putting together the portfolios. On the next slide, I have some bullets about the data, but I guess we'll take questions about the methodology here.
Okay, yeah, that'd be good. We do have a few people in the queue. So we'll go ahead and take the first question. Just a reminder to identify yourself first.
Hi, this is Matt Friedman with the Utility Reform Network. Arnie, when I look at some of the slides that you guys also released that are on the CAISO website that are the supporting documentation and taken in tandem with what you just said, it sounds like you're modeling a base case in which any RPS-eligible renewable energy has to be directly delivered to California, in other words, to satisfy what would be called the Bucket 1 or Product Content Category 1 requirements. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's one exception to that, which is the resources that are designated as REC resources that could be delivered over existing transmission. So we have some of those in the current portfolio. There's about 3,000 megawatts of existing out-of-state resources in the existing portfolio by 2020. Those we're assuming can be delivered locally in their local area. We're also assuming that the resources designated as REC resources can be delivered in their local area. But in keeping with how procurement practice, basically in keeping with current procurement practice, we're assuming that otherwise new out-of-state wind resources would be basically bucket one dynamically transferred to the ISO area or to another California balancing area.
So does that mean that there's no assumption that any California, that California load-serving entities would procure the maximum quantities of buckets 2 and 3 resources that they are permitted to procure under existing state law?
You know, Matt, it's possible that, you know, so the model picks some out-of-state resources, and we made available 5,000 megawatts of resources for them to pick from. It certainly is possible that some of those could be procured as bucket 2 or bucket 3. We have kind of identified some of them, you know, carved some of them out as bucket 3. You know, the current practice is it's largely the bucket one that's been procured out of state, but you know we don't have any information to say that they would do these as bucket one, bucket two, or bucket three, what the relative costs of doing each type of arrangement would be, and the relative risks of having those resources not count towards the RPS because you couldn't demonstrate to the PUC satisfaction of that.
So I guess I'm sort of confused. It sounds like you're designating some resources that could be procured under the current practice scenario that would essentially be bucket two or three, or you're not assuming incremental procurement there. It's I'm a little confused.
Yeah, sorry for that. We're designating some as specifically bucket three. Those are the ones that are labeled RECs. Of the other out-of-state resources, we're treating them just for operational purposes as if they were bucket one. But there's nothing to say, as you point out, that those couldn't also be or instead be procured as bucket two. But yeah, we're assuming that they're bucket one in the modeling.
Okay. Well, I guess I would just throw out there, and I think you know what I'm going to say here, which is up to a quarter of the 50% RPS can be procured with buckets 2 and 3, which has no delivery requirements in real time. And so I think to ignore that possibility simply by looking at recent procurement transactions is a mistake and doesn't reflect current practice or doesn't reflect a reasonable expectation of where things go under a base case. So.
Thank you for your comments.
So we'll go ahead and take the next question.
Bucket one resources.
Hi, this is Paul Nelson from Southern California Edison. So my understanding for scenario three and the 2030 case where we're looking at a wider market, and my understanding from earlier, this is going to be the U.S.-based WEC less the power marketing agencies. So my question is the in terms of RPS and the access to these high-quality resources, how are you accounting for the fact that other states also have RPS standards that are going to be met in the future? So it seems to me there's going to be a competition for these high-quality resources. How is that impacted into the scenario three?
So Resolve does have a high-level representation of the operational characteristics of those other regions, and we have reflected in those other regions renewable resources, you know, that are sufficient to meet the sort of current statutory RPSs in those regions. So we do have, you know, some impact in the economics that we might be consuming the ability of those regions to integrate the resources. With respect to the supply curve, we really haven't done any work on saying, you know, how many megawatts of resources are there available in New Mexico or Wyoming, and what's the potential amount of load in New Mexico and Utah that might be sort of competing for those resources. I think it's our sense that the rest of the West is relatively sparsely populated, and there's really a lot of high-quality wind available, in especially in the New Mexico and Wyoming areas. So even if others are out there sort of prospecting in the same area, there seems to be plenty to go around, and that's the assumption that we've made.
So is the other states' RPS errors, is that also a hard input to Resolve for scenario three?
Yes. Yeah, it's the same input for all the scenarios.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Paul. All right, Lauren, we did switch operators, by the way. Lauren, we'll go ahead and take the next question in the queue.
Hi, Arnie, it's Keith White, California PNC staff. I have three questions. The first concerns existing contracts. How does the portfolio construction treat the pretty big backlog of existing contracts? Does it assign any failure rate, or does it take them all as sunk and have to be included in the portfolio, or what do you do about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. What we're doing there is consistent with the RPS calculator, is that, you know, we're effectively assuming approximately 33% by 2020 as a starting point. So we're not assuming that there's any ability to change that portfolio as a result of regional integration. So that's why there's only one RPS portfolio that Brattle is modeling in PSO in 2020. And I think that does, Keith, assume all those contracts. It assumes whatever's in the calculator with respect to the failure rate.
So, but some of those contracts could get you beyond 33%, depending, of course, on what failure rate you assume. So do those also get included?
Yeah, when we added it all up, it was 32.7%. It was a little short of 33.
Okay, I maybe need to talk with you in the future about that, but I'll go to the second question. Do you assume energy-only delivery for all of these resources?
Yeah, we're using the energy-only costs from the PUC ISO special study work that was done. So I think it's not that everything has to be energy-only. I think there actually might be a couple of zones in there that are still have FCDS status, but it's largely energy only.
Okay. The last question. So does the regional expansion of the balancing authority footprint, how does that impact what qualifies under Bucket 1, since now you've got presumably it's a still a California majority balancing authority that extends kind of far and wide.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, we decided not to try to get into a detailed accounting of what is already Bucket 1, 2, and 3, what could be Bucket 1, 2, and 3 in the future, and the relative costs and risks of all those different ways of procuring renewable energy. So instead, you know, what we've done is shown you very explicitly how many megawatts of out-of-state resources we've made available in each of the scenarios and what we've assumed for delivery and cost of those resources, and we let the model pick the least cost set from among them. So for scenario 3, for example, it picks, you know, 1,500 megawatts each of Wyoming wind and New Mexico wind, and it picks some transmission associated with those. So whether those would end up being bucket 1 or bucket 2 or bucket 3 under the current portfolio content categories, it's very, very hard for me to handicap, you know, what the kind of regulatory framework and decisions would be along those lines. So we've shown you what we've made available, and we'll show you what percentage of total energy is picked in each case. And so then we can compare that to the bucket 1 and bucket 2 and bucket 3 allowances and, you know, kind of draw our own conclusions about whether, you know, whether we think those are compliant with the current rules or whether the current rules would need to be adapted in order to make these portfolios a reality.
And, Keith, this is Deb Levine with the ISO. On purpose, we are not doing any of the bucket analysis. All we're trying to do in accordance with the legislation is determine what the ratepayer impact is if the ISO becomes a regional organization. So the portfolios that we put together are merely plausible portfolios. It's not the ISO's intention that any of these portfolios establish what the procurement requirements are for load-serving entities within California. We're just trying to come up with portfolios to lead into the answers required by the legislation for the ISO to be a regional organization.
So you're not explicitly assessing
delivery to quote unquote California load. Is it?
Correct.
Thanks.
We can't. I mean, if we come up with a portfolio, we can't say, "Well, PG&E has to procure this, and City of Anaheim has to procure that." We don't have that authority.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Lauren. We'll take the next question.
Hi, this is Meredith Youngheim from the CPC. I'm sorry that you're hearing from two of us back to back. Hi, Arnie. So my question is more specifically about the relationship between the resource choices that Resolve is making and the current RPS calculator used by the CPC. So for everyone's benefit on the phone, the RPS calculator under certain scenarios does pick out-of-state resources of fairly large quantities, you know, to fill the 50% RPS in 2030. So you said that you're assuming 3,000 megawatts of out-of-state in 2020. Are you assuming that incremental amounts above that would only occur with regionalization, or how is this model making those choices? And I just wanted to say that I don't think the bucket discussion is as important as understanding that, because the RPS calculator has the buckets hardwired into it, but it's still choosing, it's still finding that out-of-state resources would be economic for California under certain scenarios, which then assumes that they may be fully deliverable or they may be energy only. We may build transmission to make those resources bucket one. So could you explain that a little bit more? Thanks.
Yeah, certainly. So just to answer your first question about sort of the benchmarking, you know, we haven't done a full benchmarking analysis here. When we were doing early runs with Resolve, under the same assumptions that the RPS calculator is using, we were coming up with very similar answers with respect to the quantity of in-state wind, in-state solar, out-of-state wind, out-of-state solar. So we that gave us a lot of confidence.
Sorry,
that
meaning under the base case scenario, you were reaching the same result.
No, this is way. This is way before that, Meredith. This is really when we were testing the model. That was kind of our one of our tests is, you know, we were pretty confident in the economics, how the RPS calculator performed. We wanted to see how Resolve would perform given the same set of assumptions. And the portfolios were quite similar. Then, you know, for the purpose of this study, and this kind of goes along with what Deb said, you know, we're not using this study as kind of the most unbiased forecast of where California procurement would come out. As we're trying to do with the RPS calculator, we're really trying to put together some plausible portfolios to measure the effect of regional integration on RPS procurement costs in California. And in doing so, we wanted to be, you know, very conservative in making sure that we're not overstating the benefits. One of the first things that we looked at as a team is, well, in the RPS calculator, there really wasn't any representation of out-of-state resources that could be delivered over existing transmission. This is something that had been included in the earlier versions of the RPS calculator because there was a lot of procurement activity out-of-state going on. But because there wasn't really any of that activity going on, we didn't even think to include it in version 6.0 of the calculator. And when we had our workshop last February, there wasn't a single stakeholder that said, oh, this is missing. Right. Now that we've gone to the 50% formally, and we're trying to make sure that we're not overstating the effect of regional integration. We said, well, maybe we should assume that there's some resources available that could be delivered over existing transmission, even under the current practice case. And so we've made available 5,000 megawatts of resources that aren't in the RPS calculator, that are out-of-state resources, largely wind, some solar. They provide diversity with respect to the California resources. They don't require big new transmission investments. So the model, they're available for the model to pick, and it wants to pick them in most of the cases that we run, even under the current practice case. So that's
okay.
The difference between what we've done here and what's coming out of the RPS.
That's really helpful, and maybe as a follow-up, someone could email me and tell me where in the documents that are posted online that's explained, because I just read them all and could not get that information from them. So thank you.
We'll follow up with you.
So, Arnie, we have three additional questions in the queue. What we'll do is we'll take those questions, and then we really do need to move on. So, operator, if you can open up the line of the next person in the queue.
Hi, this is Carolyn Barbash with Pacificorp. Arnie, I just wanted a clarification. You said you were going to get into the transmission assumptions. And back when we were on slide 7, too, there was some discussion about the transmission proxies from Wyoming and New Mexico being in the 2030 mm-hmm. case. I just wanted to clarify, those are in both the current practice case and the integration case, right? It's or are they only in the integration case?
Yeah, those are only in the integration case. This was
okay,
going to be kind of my next comment.
Yeah, and why is that?
It's our, you know, there's been out-of-state resource zones proposed for, you know, 10 years for, you know, big new transmission lines to be delivered to California. And they've never, even though they've been economic in a variety of studies and sometimes quite economic, they've never have been developed. So it's our judgment that it's highly unlikely that large new quantities of the best resources, you know, on the eastern slopes of the Rockies, can be developed in the absence of some type of regional transmission entity that can, you know, has a view of transmission planning needs across an entire region and potentially the ability to allocate transmission costs. Now, they're too big. They don't fit into any one utility solicitation, you know, which they do year by year. Just the logistics of trying to get those types of deals, multi-state deals approved, we think are quite daunting. And one of the potential real benefits of a regional entity that, you know, doesn't have just a California perspective but has a perspective of the transmission needs across a broad area.
Okay, thank you. That's
Hey, Arnie, just to clarify, new transmission is built only in Regional 3, so Regional Case 2 does not have that new transmission.
Yeah, thanks for the clarification, Hannah. That's right. This is Regional 3 is the one where we've sort of opened up the entire western region for procurement of renewable energy to meet California's needs.
Thank you.
Carolyn? Okay, we'll go on to the next question.
Hi, Kevin Woodruff, consultant for TURN. Two questions, or one question, one comment. When you, in Resolve, you do, I mean, as I understand it, when you do sort of the choosing of renewables to fill out the portfolios, you look at the estimated transmission costs as well. In the actual, how do those transmission costs, how do those get input into the total analysis, the total cost effectiveness analysis? Are those sort of part of renewables, or are those done separately, sort of carried on outside of your model and put into some other, you know, aggregation of costs?
They're endogenous to the model, so the model doesn't pick Wyoming or New Mexico wind unless the PPA price plus the cost of the new transmission makes it the lowest cost resource.
Okay.
So inside the model, and then in our ratepayer estimate for California, we'll be assuming that the cost of those new transmission lines are fully borne by California ratepayers in scenario 3. So we won't be assuming that any share of those lines are picked up and paid for by some ratepayers outside of California and outside of our analysis.
Okay, and those costs, are those are evident, or those are evident somewhere in the ratepayer analysis in Resolve results, or somewhere else in something that Judy's and Johannes' firm are going to put together.
Yeah, we'll identify those separately so you can see what we've assumed there.
Okay, and when you pick these transmission lines, you pick presumably if it's, say, a 1,000-megawatt capacity line, you build a 1,000-megawatt capacity line. Do you assume that the line is filled with renewables? In other words, if that 1,000 megawatts is fully utilized or utilized as much as possible, given the renewables load, generation profiles.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, we haven't done a really detailed analysis of how much you could overbuild the wind zone given a fixed size of the transmission line, or whether there's any other uses of that transmission line which might be able to cover some of the costs. We're basically assuming, for costing purposes, it's just a pipe from the wind directly into California, and it's only used half the time.
Okay. Okay.
Now, those lines, I think Hanna said those lines are also brought into PSO, and so their PSO would be picking up some of these other potential dispatch benefits from the lines.
And PSO is the production cost model?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. The other observation is, I didn't quite catch all your one of your discussions with Keith White about the starting RPS percentage. The utilities are, you're probably more familiar with the data than I am, but 33% might end up being on the low side by 2020. Maybe not hugely, but it's certainly with the IOU procurement, because they tend to go longer and make the program work, frankly. But I'll just make that comment, and I can point you to some data on that are public.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have all the data from the CCAs either, so we're just
taking some of that is public, but
yeah, we're taking the IOU contracts and using those as the starting point. The IOU contract has reflected in their quarterly reports to the PUC, so they're quite up to date. It's possible there's some additional procurement that we haven't incorporated in there, but
right.
It's also possible. He said that there's some contract failure from some of the aggressive pricing. So, we think it's pretty reasonable to say what's in play is the increment between 33% and 50%.
Yeah, maybe. Okay, thanks. That's it.
Okay, Lauren, we're going to take, I know that we have one more question that we promised to answer, and it sounds like it's a quick one. So, but we do need to move on because we're approaching 11 o'clock. We still have two more presentations to go through. So, we'll go ahead and take Rachel's question, and then Arnie can move on to through the rest of his presentation.
Great. Thanks,
so go ahead.
Christina. This is Rachel Gold from the Large Scale Solar Association. Arnie, I just had a quick question, I think, for you, which is as we try to figure out what level of RPS you're modeling as being currently contracted, it would be helpful to know which exact version of the calculator you're working on to try to have a sense of which contracts that have been executed are included.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question, and we'll have to get back to you with that information.
Okay, thanks. That's it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Rachel. All right, Arnie, we're going to go ahead and move on.
Okay.
Do you want to just go through your
slide?
Yeah.
It just highlights some of the areas where we've made changes in response to stakeholder comments after the February workshop. The CEC's 2015 IPER load forecast was available then, and I think Judy has already referred to that. Some of the highlights of the changes are that load is lower than what we assumed before. We decided that we would just go with the electric vehicle adoption assumption that was in the IPER forecast, rather than a separate kind of pathways-based analysis. So we have fewer EVs in the load now, which also serves to reduce load. And we have more rooftop PV, which reduces the amount of central station RPS that we have to procure, but does add to the integration burdens that the system has to. We realized that we needed to do a statewide analysis and not just an ISO footprint analysis. So we've made some assumptions about what the renewable energy procurement activity looks like for the Sacramento area, the Los Angeles area, Imperial Irrigation District. We haven't run those through Resolve. We're still running the Resolve analysis just for the ISO footprint, but we've added some assumptions about the procurement for those other areas and how that might change under a regional integration, which we'll be able to show you in a couple of weeks. We have reduced the cost of all of our renewable resources in response to stakeholder comments. Previously, we were sticking to the sort of officially sanctioned PUC state-sanctioned costs in the RPS calculator. But in response to the stakeholder comments, we looked at it. We realized we probably had drifted a little bit away from where the market was today. And so we took another look and kind of recalibrated our prices for all three large renewable types, wind, solar, and geothermal, and also took another look at the performance of those resources as well and recalibrated those estimates. And I think those materials have been posted. We took another look at our battery storage cost as a result of stakeholder comments, and we made a number of changes to how we were characterizing the battery costs, reducing the capital cost, adding inverter replacement, increasing balance of systems, et cetera. The net effect of these changes is to pretty significantly reduce the cost of batteries both in the near term and in the long run. And we do have quite an aggressive trajectory for battery costs between now and 2030. And as a result, it's kind of exciting that the model now wants to pick some battery technology in some of the cases, which we'll be able to show you. Another change that we've made, which is also significant, is that the ISO is continually refining its estimates of what kind of resources it really needs to operate during times of overgeneration. Any kind of thermal resource that has to operate when we're curtailing solar will, of course, add to that curtailment, will increase the amount of curtailment that has to happen. So it's continuing to look at those assumptions, and what we've done now is the latest change that the team has made is to assume that both hydro and all of our existing storage can provide the frequency response service that the ISO had previously been assuming would be provided by gas generation. And so as a result, there are actually some hours where we're turning off all of the gas generation on the California system, and we're running it only with wind and solar and hydro and the existing pump storage and the mandated battery storage, at least in. So this makes quite a big impact in reducing the amount of curtailment that we're seeing under the current practice case, and therefore reducing the benefits that we would expect to see under a regional integration case. And just to note there that we're still kind of tabulating and finalizing all of our results, so we don't have them to show yet, but we'll show you what the changes that Beth has made on the portfolios at our next workshop later this month.
All right, thank you. So what we're going to do is we'll take a couple questions. We do have the Bear presentation in Aspen that we need to get through. But, just keep in mind we will take written questions following the meeting, and you can submit those to the regional integration mailbox. So are there any questions in the queue at this time, Lauren?
Yes, we do have one question in queue.
Great, thank you.
Good morning. This is Dave Schmidt.
Good morning, Dave.
Can you hear me? Thank you. I'm with Transwest Express. And Arnie, through some of your presentation and some of your answers to the questions, you described various differences from, you said sanctioned data or so in the RPS calculator. And I think that, from our perspective, it seems that the assumption about there being more, you mentioned that there was no discussion around the RPS calculator about available transmission being available, but you've made the judgment that to make some more available, that would be a conservative estimate so that you get the SB 350 and not overstating the benefits. And again, you mentioned that you changed the assumptions around the resources. And again, that's a conservative assumption as well, so we understand that. You also highlighted your judgment about the ability to have a transmission project move forward as represented in the RPS calculator as a direct connection into California. Those are in. That's how things are getting selected. But you mentioned your judgment was that would be very difficult. that doesn't seem like a conservative assumption, and so I just wanted to get a sense from you about what kind of went into that decision making on that judgment, because it seems like a very aggressive assumption in my view.
Yeah, thanks for the comment, Dave. You know, I think I spoke at this about this at some length previously, but you know, it really is a matter of having observed the market and how it's played out over the last several years. You know, looking at how the utilities in California do procurement, which tends to be on a year-by-year basis, procuring kind of a few hundred megawatts at a time, and each of them acting independently. And that the procurement activity is becoming, you know, more and more kind of fractured as we have more CCAs that are taking over these duties from the IOUs. It becomes, I think, harder and harder for a very large, lumpy new project that requires, you know, the approval of multiple states all along the way to really, you know, achieve kind of a critical mass to get that going. And there's some risk associated with that as well. If these transmission lines have a very long lead time, you have to be sure that when you get to the other end of the transmission line being built, that the resources that are there available to you to procure are actually as lower cost than as they appeared to be when you started the process. And maybe there's some certainty you can get on contracting through that. But, you know, just between the lumpiness and the risk and the number of entities that have to be involved, it sure seems to me that if you had a single transmission planning entity with a regional view and a regional footprint and with the ability to do cost allocation, frankly, for new transmission investments, that path gets a lot smoother. And you're right, it's probably not black and white. You know, if there's a 10% chance or a 20% chance that this can happen under current practice, and an 80% or a 90% chance that it could happen under regional integration, you know, that's maybe a little bit less conservative than what we've assumed here. But that's just kind of, I think, my view of it, and I think it's probably shared by the whole team.
Okay, I thank you for that answer. I just want to point out to everyone, including the folks in the CPUC, this is a departure from what's in the RPS calculator and hasn't been part of any of that conversation, including with, you know, as you support that process. So it is a departure. And I think, you know, the reason why I asked the question is I think it's not a conservative assumption like all the others. So that's why, you know, we'll probably continue to ask this question, Arnie. So, and, you know, a lot of what you mentioned, procurement and everything else, I'm not sure how that procurement changes due to a regional transmission entity and permitting and all those other things. But we'll continue to monitor your assumptions and the study as you go forward. So thank you.
Yeah, no, fair enough, David. You know, we've always had the calculator. We've always kind of run it both ways, with the Wyoming line in and with it not in, and shown everyone, here's what the numbers look like with it in and with it not in. But I think as far as what assumptions have been given over to the ISO for its transmission planning process, which is that is kind of the formal use of the RPS calculator. I don't think any of the cases have had that Wyoming line assumed.
The RPS calculator was just updated, and I think they're going to send this stuff soon, so I agree with you on that. Thank you.
Okay, Lauren, it looks like that was the only question we had in the queue, so we will go ahead and move on to Vera's presentation. So, David, are you on the line?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is David. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Great. All right. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for this opportunity to brief you on our assessment and on the economic assessment, at least for my part. My name is David Rollenholtz, and I'm the founder of Berkeley Economic Advising and Research and also an economics professor at UC Berkeley. I'm going to go quickly because we do have a little bit of time to make up, but if I don't cover sufficient detail in any specifics, please catch up with me in the question and answer. As you know, we posted four documents online as part of the submission to stakeholders, and these are pretty technical documents. There are a lot of details here that would only be of interest to real economics geeks, I guess, but what they describe is a an economic forecasting tool that's been in play in California climate policy for about a decade since the legislative run-up to AB 32. This is the BEAR model, which is an economy-wide model of California. And as you know, the SB 350 legislation stipulates that an economic assessment be part of this process. So we've taken that piece of it on. I'm going to summarize just not so much the technical issues, but some of the conceptual issues, and also try to give you a sense of the coverage of our assessment. Let's begin with the next slide. That's number 12. Just some basic principles about the main things that we're focusing on, which are job creation and incomes. On the employment side, as I think you're all aware, infrastructure investment is primarily a short-term, what we call a Keynesian stimulus. It creates the so-called shovel-ready jobs to establish infrastructure, but it's relatively short-lived in the context of specific projects. The second type of employment creation that we see with an in-state solution, the RPS, is capacity investment, which creates both short and long-term jobs, depending on the import content of the capacity. So if the panels are not made in California, then the upstream manufacturing job creation won't happen in California. But still, there'll be significant impacts on assembly, construction, employment, mainly for the short term, but also ongoing for O&M. Another really important component of demand and employment creation as a result of these policies is going to be what we call expenditure shifting. And that'll result, if as expected, we see ratepayer savings as a result of a more efficient energy supply system. And in that context, there's an interesting so-called invisible jobs. The visible jobs are pretty easy to track in the build-out. But the invisible jobs are jobs that result from ratepayer savings being essentially diverted from electric power demand to things that households, the other stuff that households like to have and enterprises like to spend their money on. And as you know, in California, 70% of household expenditure is on services. That's a much more job-intensive part of the economy. And so a dollar, let's just sort of visualize this. If you take a dollar out of your electricity meter and you get to spend it on the things you're used to, then in California we spend about two-thirds of our income on haircuts and espresso drinks, right? So labor-intensive services. Those jobs are more diverse. They're more numerous on a per dollar of expenditure basis. And they're also more likely to be in-state jobs because service sector employment is not a tradable form of employment. And so it's these jobs really can't be outsourced. They're part of the bedrock of the California labor source. So those are the three main components of employment creation that we'll be looking at in that assessment. And there's one more dimension of the economic impact that we really want to emphasize, and that is the so-called pro-poor effect of efficiency in electric power supply. As you probably know, lower-income households are pretty much obliged to spend a larger proportion of their income on this essential good or service, depending on how you define electricity, because lower-income families don't necessarily make the technology choices for their electric power use. They don't choose their appliances in many cases, or their home insulation options. Those are chosen by their landlords. So there's a very strong, what we call a progressive income effect of lower rates, and we're going to try to capture those characteristics. Let me give you, just on the next slide, which is number 13, a sense of what the sort of framework of the estimation is. At the center of it is the BEAR model that I already referred to, which is a very detailed dynamic forecasting model that estimates economic activity across the state for 190 sectors in the economy. And it does it so on an annual basis going from 2016 to 2030. We're going to use inputs which are customary for the projection work that we do, and that's very detailed economic data. that we generate ourselves from official sources and econometric estimates. Then we're getting data from our partners who are the best in the business on the technical side. E3 and Brattle are giving us the main technical data for the scenarios, and the details here, I won't read all that to you, but you've heard a lot already about the assumptions behind those estimates. Then from that, we get three types of estimates at the moment. We're focusing on statewide impacts, and I'll list those for you in a second. Then we're going down to more detailed results, and the first is the occupational detail, because we know that's quite important to the what we call the political economy of these policies, which stakeholders are affected and in what way. And so we've got 22 different employment categories that we're trying to track in these estimates. Then we go down to a more detailed spatial assessment, because there's a mandate in the legislation for identifying the effects on disadvantaged communities. And to get to the disadvantaged community level, we have to essentially map the bare results, the statewide results, through something called the in-plan data. Some of you may be familiar with this, but this is very detailed county-level data. And we go from in-plan, and I'll show you this schematically in a minute. We take that from the county level then to the census tract level, which is the geographic framework by which disadvantaged communities are defined. So that's basically the way the results are essentially projected spatially. Going to the next slide, we can summarize the macro data that we're looking at right now. The Bayer model generates a lot of information, but we're focusing in this assessment first on the traditional macroeconomic aggregates. So we're looking at aggregate employment. We're looking at employment by sector. We'll be looking at employment by household. And also, households are disaggregated by income deciles because we feel the distributional consequences of these policies are quite important to understand. And labor categories, as I said already, we've got skilled and unskilled occupations. We've got 22 different categories trying to get a better sense of what the composition of job creation is going to look like. And then gross state product, as we all understand, is value added at the aggregate level and also by sector. We'll be looking at personal income and real income, that is essentially purchasing power income at the decile level, and also real wages and incomes for labor categories. Enterprise income, we don't have a lot of detail on the enterprise sector apart from the individual sectors. Within sectors, we don't discriminate between large, medium, and small firms, although we know that's an interesting issue. It's not part of our existing mandate. And then finally, we've got a lot of fiscal data and fiscal variables that we're following, just to get a sense of what the state's budget implications of this will be. Okay, next slide, number 15. Oops, sorry. This kind of schematically shows you what I referred to before, how we get down to the disadvantaged community level. Those are the highlighted red areas in the map. And we have individual census tract information, which will allow us to associate the aggregate results through the in-plan results at the county level and project those to the disadvantaged community level. And there we're going to be following essentially five types of variables: employment levels, wages, real household income, real household consumption. Again, this is really important to this expenditure shifting element, and household energy costs, real energy costs for households. Okay, if I may summarize, the basic objective of this whole exercise is something that we've always been really interested in because we think it's essential to the policy dialogue, and that is to promote evidence-based assessment and design of policies. So we're completely on board with the ISO's approach to this, which is transparency and robust stakeholder engagement, and we're trying to provide evidence to support that. We're also trying to better elucidate the income and job dynamics, particularly the so-called invisible job effects, because, of course, there are individual stakeholder groups that are very good at identifying and publicizing the expected effects on their on their constituents, but the effects on the overall economy of something as pervasive as the energy system really need to be carefully understood, because the indirect effects of these policies often significantly outweigh the direct effects. So we want to try to make that clear to the entire audience of potentially affected parties. Economic model data and scenarios, these are all technical issues, including the many assumptions you've already heard about. And we're happy to have an ongoing discussion about that before, during, and after the assessment. And then finally, we've benefited a lot from our previous engagement during the stakeholder process, and we hope to benefit now and in the future. We've gotten better data and more diverse perspectives. We've been able to shift our emphasis in ways that are more responsive to interests. Because effective policy isn't just about trying to reward certain groups. We have to anticipate the needs of those who might be affected in other ways, not beneficiaries, but maybe indirect beneficiaries, or those who may have adjustment costs that need to be identified. And then, of course, we can discuss assumptions, and we should discuss assumptions so that this exercise is credible. As it can be. Following Arnie, I'll just make a couple of comments about things that we've learned in the last round of stakeholder engagement. We got access to some very good data from other states for the sake of comparison. Particularly, NREL was helpful with this, and their JEDI modeling facility has given us some information about renewable supply chains. We've also revisited census tract data after listening to some NGO stakeholders who are much more intimately familiar with the detailed disadvantaged community issues and local realities in some of these areas. And then finally, we've been able to get better disaggregation of occupational data to follow our mapping from the state level down to the county and the disadvantaged community level. So, very useful, and thank you all for sharpening our perspectives on some of these issues. And I'm happy to take questions.
Great, thank you. So we will take questions at this time. You can press pound 2 on your telephone keypad, and that will place you in the queue. Just a reminder to identify yourself first.
Hi, this is Matt Friedman with the Utility Reform Network. Just to get a sense of how different impacts are kind of moving the outcomes you're looking at under the model, how, from what you're saying, it sounds like that cheaper energy, making energy cheaper to retail customers and producing those types of savings kind of dominates the outcome in the model. Is that a fair assessment? That it's a much bigger impact than any of the sort of questions of where actual investment occurs for new infrastructure?
It's tempting to spoil the surprise, but we actually don't have final results yet. However, what you're talking about is a very fundamental dynamic inside of the modeling framework. And what I will say is that there's no question that that expenditure shifting that comes from ratepayer savings is a much more labor-intensive form of demand. It's a demand, frankly speaking, and without prejudice, the energy system, particularly the conventional energy system, is one of the least employment-intensive activities in the economy. And so if you take, as I said, a dollar, you take it out of your gas tank or you take it out of your meter, figuratively, and you spend it on what consumers normally spend their money on, which is the three-quarters of it goes to services, you'll create much more employment per dollar. Now, the ultimate assessment result that we're going to get will depend upon the relative magnitudes of the ratepayer adjustment and the relative magnitudes of the investment that are made in the so-called visible jobs, right? The invisible jobs, as I said, are streaming through a much wider spectrum of economic activities, and they also have a higher job content per dollar. But we're still in the process of weighing this balance, so I can't tell you the verdict. I frankly don't know. We don't have the final estimates on the ratepayer impact. But those dynamics are quite important, and I find them also especially important because these are
as I said, visible versus invisible, direct versus indirect, very different stakeholder groups, so it's really important to take account of those effects. But unfortunately, I don't have a final answer on that yet.
Okay, but the results that you folks produce will show each of those impacts separately, so folks can analyze
absolutely
them.
Absolutely, we'll decompose that very carefully, and it's I think it's also essential to the policy dialogue because, as I said, you know, certain stakeholder groups are very articulate and focused when it comes to their interest, and this is like environmental work. You know, the one individual stakeholder might have a very concentrated essential individual stake in a policy, but the impacts might be very dispersed and widespread, and the other affected parties may, if it's a positive or a negative externality, it doesn't matter. Somebody's got to at least elucidate what those indirect effects are, and we'll do that as clearly as we possibly can because we think it's quite important. Also, in terms of engaging a larger audience, you know, frankly, I'm an economist. I'm not an energy system expert, and as a layperson in a latter context, I know that some of this can look pretty arcane and technical when you're talking about advanced energy systems. But ratepayer savings are something that every household and enterprise in California understands, right? So this is a message that we will try to make as clear as possible.
Okay, just one more question. The, you know, as I understand the way the modeling is being done in the resolve process, there's not an attempt to match particular types of, for example, cheaper renewable energy with individual utilities. It's kind of done at a very high level for the entire system. But in fact, what happens is that individual utilities make specific purchases, and so any sort of cost savings that are assumed wouldn't be passed on uniformly or on an average basis to all utilities. Some utilities would be bigger winners than others. Some CCAs would be bigger winners than others. And that means that really you'd want to look at different geographical distributions of benefits. But I'm assuming that that's not what you did because it's very problematic to try to figure out how that would happen, right?
Oh, don't underestimate my colleagues at E3. They've worked very hard to try to get these technical details down, but Arnie's got to answer that question because I don't know. Arnie, you there?
Yes, this is Arnie Olson with E3. The ratepayer analysis is just going to be statewide. We're not trying to model the impact on individual utilities, CCAs, munis, and inside the California borders. It's just the entire state.
So, but when you're flowing it through then to the local level, you're just assuming everybody gets sort of an average amount of benefits, for example. You're not attempting to look at whether PG&E ratepayers may do better than Edison ratepayers, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is Deb Levine with the ISO.
Sorry,
this is Deb Levine with the ISO. As I said earlier, the analysis is for California, and the portfolios that we came up with that start all the costs are just plausible ones. It's not expected that the utilities are going to go out and 15 years from now procure the resources that we've established for the 2030 analysis.
Okay, and you would also be then looking at, for example, benefits for LADWP customers, but assuming that they're joining the RTO?
Correct.
Okay, thank
Again,
you.
The legislation is for California, not for the California ISO.
Okay, it looks like we don't have any other questions, so let's move on to our last presentation by Aspen, and the speaker is Brewster. Brewster?
Hi. My name is Brewster Birdsall, and I'm from Aspen Environmental Group, and we're leading the environmental study, and our material that was posted in advance of this call covers what we call a methodology overview, and there are really two components, and so Aspen's slide presentation here is very brief, one slide for each component of our early material, and There's not a lot of content here on the slide. My intent is that for detail we would look to the methodology report that was posted. But the first slide shows within the methodology overview, and I'll call it an overview because there are some aspects of the methodology that we're still working on and refining. Within the methodology overview, we penciled out a basic study approach. We introduce a concept of study zones, which I will describe here in a minute, and then also identify some of the metrics that we are using to characterize the baseline conditions for certain locations that are under study, and then how those metrics may be used as indicators of impact. And this appears in a table in our report that's essentially called How Topics Would Be Analyzed. We can move to the second slide, but I expect most questions will probably be on the environmental overview if there are questions on that. But the second slide introduces the second part of our posted material, which is a review of how disadvantaged communities are identified and screened in our work. And for this, we are adhering very closely and taking verbatim, essentially, scores that have been assigned to each census tract in California from the CalEnviroScreen 2.0 model. We're looking and categorizing the 25% highest scoring census tracts as disadvantaged communities, and our posted material shows some maps and tables on how those communities are distributed per county, per air basin, and within the CREZs, and CREZs are the renewable energy zones that we will be looking at. And those zones tie back to the study areas that I mentioned in the first slide. Just to go back to the environmental overview, and we can toggle back one slide, and I'll run through some of the highlights. The environmental work is downstream of the capacity modeling and portfolio development processes, and also the production cost simulation modeling that you've already heard about. The two different processes and the two different models that are being used, the Resolve model is really giving us the locations of the renewable build-out in a very coarse manner, and that means by resource zone and by renewable technology. And within California, for example, there are really 12 or so, maybe one or two more, types of zones and resources that are being selected by the Resolve model. And so those zones are very, very large and very coarse. The production cost modeling, on the other hand, is very fine-grained and provides information on how the system will change in terms of megawatt hours produced on a unit-by-unit generating unit basis. And our approach to deal with this disparate, coarse, and fine-grained difference of information is to really treat the environmental impacts according to what is really being driven by the models. We're not trying to refine the results of these two different modeling efforts by the rest of the study team partners. But what we'll do is we'll try to arrive at an environmental analysis that essentially defines kind of a middle ground of the coarse renewable build out along with the fine-grained operational results from the production cost modeling. And to do so, for the renewables build-outs, we're developing study zones. These study zones are really going to serve as a proxy location that will help us focus our environmental study within those larger zones of renewable resources that have been selected by the Resolve model. And for us, this means that we will be drawing, and we are drawing, lines on a map that show zones of potential renewable siting. And we're going to we're going to essentially be following areas and align these zones with areas where siting of renewable generation resources has been historically successful. We tailor the shapes of these zones, especially for wind, based on the availability of the resource and to avoid high conflict and high risk areas that have been identified in earlier proceedings and earlier efforts to plan renewables throughout the West. These study zone boundaries will be, I think, an interesting component of the material we'll be presenting at the end of the month, and so they may raise a host of questions on their own right. But the point of Aspen developing these boundaries is really to just zero in our environmental study so that we can characterize typical environmental and natural resources in the areas that are being selected by the RESOLVE model. I'd like to say one thing aside from the study zones, that we have to contemplate the potential for a new transmission, and this is really appearing in the regional case 3 only, and that's been talked about a little bit already this morning by both Arnie and Judy. And for the environmental impacts of new transmission, we're going to be looking at environmental studies that have been already prepared for Gateway West, and we know that in New Mexico some environmental work has already been done on SunZia. So we'll be summarizing the results in the literature for those projects, but really we are not going to be describing them in specific terms. We're going to describe the environmental impacts in a relatively general sense, and that's because the overall effort here is not to identify one particular transmission project as being favored, but to recognize that there are many transmission solutions that can be implemented between now and 2030. And just a reminder that the RESOLVE build-out horizon is 2030, and so there's still a 15-year horizon during which any number of transmission solutions can be implemented. But there's literature available on these certain transmission projects that have been early movers, and so we'll rely on that literature. The range of environmental topics and the baseline conditions that we're looking at are really key to just a couple environmental issue areas. And this is because of the high nature and sort of regional context of this study. We're going to cover the land use topic, the biological resources. We'll talk a little bit about water, and then highlight air emissions changes, and that includes the greenhouse gas and CO2 emissions changes due to the changes in dispatch. And for each of these topics, the approach is a little bit different. For land use, we're really relying on the study zones that Aspen is developing, and we're looking at the results of the RESOLVE model to help us identify where the new renewable resources may be constructed. And to accomplish an impact analysis, we'll be tying those new resource capacity additions to certain zones, and within those zones we'll be taking a look at population density and also the existing land uses to identify what kinds of land use conversion effects may occur and what kind of population density may be affected. For biological resources, again, we'll be really using the RESOLVE portfolios to show us how certain geographies may be affected by the new construction. The key tool there will be, I'll mention that in a moment, the water and air emissions changes are more driven by a combination of where the new renewables resources will be sited, but also the results of the production cost modeling that will reveal for us and allows us to report on the changes in fuel uses and the changes in how generating technologies are responding to the regionalization, which then drives the emissions. An important point about the about the emissions results and that for criteria air pollutants, the production cost modeling directly reports nitrogen oxides and SO2. It does not directly report particulate matter, so we have an approach that we're suggesting for developing PM2.5 emissions rates, and that's detailed in our report. And the emissions results will be taken from that unit-by-unit information that's developed by the production cost modeling and then aggregated for air basins so that we can check how the emissions changes are distributed among California air basins and then versus what's occurring outside of California's borders. I'll just spend another brief moment talking about the specific details of the different topic areas and then pause for questions. I want to mention that in our early material, we mentioned that the cultural resources topic is having its methodology reviewed. We're frankly struggling with a concise and clear methodology that can be used for cultural or tribal resources. At this point, we're probably looking to acknowledge that for assessing such fine-grained or variable impacts as you might occur as might occur to cultural or tribal resources, at this high level of analysis and given the coarse nature of the potential build-outs, we probably won't have anything more than a broad qualitative statement about cultural and tribal resources. So that's something that we're working on right now, is a little bit of an evolution from what is in the early material that has already been posted. Some of the metrics that we're following, just flowing down through the rest of the report, with land use compatibility and land use conversion, we're talking about population density as it's mapped by census tracts, and then also combining that information with a quantitative review of proximity to wilderness areas and recreational resources and the like, and also air photo and satellite information. Within biological resources, a key source of data will be the crucial habitat assessment tool, and we'll be augmenting that data with state-specific and species-specific data within the zones where we are focusing. When it comes to water, we'll be looking inside California at the California Department of Water Resources definition of critically overdrafted basins, and then to help us understand the context of California groundwater resources along with groundwater stress outside of California, we propose pointing to the World Resources Institute data, and this is something that we've been working on expanding and refining a little bit since we posted that material. So that does not appear in the report, but I wanted to mention it. I've already talked a little bit about air quality and mentioned the different tools and sources of data that we'll be using. And when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions, we're really going to be looking at the changes between emissions inside California versus WECC-wide changes, and we'll put a focus on which fuels are responding to the changes as identified by the production cost modeling. And if there are questions on that, I may bring in Judy and Hannes to answer. But that pretty much gives an overview of the environmental methodology that's been posted, and if we'd like to talk about disadvantaged communities methodology, we can move on to that next, but I think this is a good time to stop and take a couple of questions.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. It looks like we do have a couple of questions in the queue, so Lauren, we'll go ahead and take the first question.
Hi, this is Ezra Hausman working with Sierra Club. My question is about the degree of resolution and detail you'll be providing on air emissions outside of California. That is the question.
Yes. Our approach really is to recognize that the production cost modeling, although is built really from the bottom up in a very fine-grained manner, that the information that's pertinent is really to just characterize what is outside what is happening outside of California versus what is inside California. Now, within California, we are planning to aggregate the information in terms of air basin, but outside of California will be treated as one geographic zone for the treatment of criteria air pollutants and also GHG.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go ahead and take the next question.
Hi, this is Carl Zakella. Two quick questions, one on the study zones, and maybe you said this and I just missed it, but I assume part of this resource zone identification is going to be using things like the solar energy zones created by the programmatic environmental impact statement that was adopted by the Bureau of Land Management, obviously the DRECP, but the other work that's been done around the West to identify resource zones, it seems to me to be we might as well use a lot of that work, including the hubs that came from the Western Governors Association and projects that were already approved, such as the ones in Wyoming. Is that how you're going at this when you say you're going to describe the study zones, or did you just look at other factors other than, you know, these efforts that have gone on and involved years of description? We also have new areas that have been identified in the San Joaquin Valley for solar energy development, and I would hope and assume that those would be included too. I have another question about air quality, but I'll let you handle the zone question first.
Yes, Carl. We will and we are very much following and using these what we've called foundational studies, including the BLM programmatic EISs from a few years back, but more recently the development focus areas within the DRECP mm-hmm. process and the San Joaquin I believe it's called Least Conflict Area Studies. I'm not sure it has an official name, but we are certainly using those resources as a means of tailoring and essentially winnowing down our study zones, so that we don't come up with results when we filter or when we look at these zones through our GIS data, so that we don't come up with results that have been essentially avoided by those processes, or results that could have been avoided had the build-out been assumed to adhere to the process. So our report that was posted gives a short bullet list of what we are relying upon, and you might want to look at that just to make sure that we've covered everything, and if we're missing something, we would look forward to hearing about it.
Great. That sounds great. On the air pollution front, it seems like this is an area where some cross-pollination between some of the other studies might be useful. We're talking about one of the major benefits financially from expansion is avoided need for flexibility reserves. That seems to me to be something that could be result in quantifiable air pollution benefits is a reduced use of natural gas resources or a reduced need for new resources. I don't know how you've talked about addressing that internally, but if it's a benefit financially, it's also an environmental benefit not to construct or operate existing resources that would not be needed any longer for flexibility. I know it's not going to be locationally specific to do it that way, but I'm just curious about how you would do it. It may be something that would not exactly be captured as an environmental benefit otherwise.
I may allow Arnie or Judy to speak to the need for new capacity additions, but the 2030 portfolio is really all renewables, and I don't think that there are new fossil generating units that are essentially added in this
portfolio.
This
is Judy Chang. If I could chime in, I think that is a very good point. There are different ways to think about additional conventional generation needs. As we described before, we are going to capture the potential financial economic impact associated with avoiding future generation needs due to low diversity across the balancing area under the regional market.
Mm-hmm.
However, we're not currently intending to quantify the potential environmental impact associated with that, primarily because we don't have a location-specific decision on where those resources would be built or could be built, or whether or not they could be built brownfield if additional plants that we haven't anticipated would retire. So I think we are going to talk about the financial and economic impact, but we're currently not, and we will describe the environmental impact associated just with those additions or potential decrease in potential additions on the environment. We're going to discuss that qualitatively.
Yeah, I realize it's a very difficult thing to put your finger on, given that locational aspect of it, and given the capacity factors of the existing natural gas fleet, I would assume that we could avoid building new capacity to provide additional flexibility, but, you know, remains to be seen, I suppose.
Very good point. Thank you.
Any other questions, Carl?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Okay, Brewster, that was all the questions in the queue, so you want to move on?
Oh, I do see one, Kevin.
Lauren, is there another question?
Yes, one just came in.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you.
Hi, this is Kevin Woodruff, consultant for Turnagain. And this last discussion sort of caused me to raise my hand. When Carl talked about, you know, there's with less flexibility reserves, there's, you know, maybe lower emissions. I mean, that's liable to be true, but wouldn't that be captured by the production cost modeling? At least to some degree.
I believe it would, Judy.
Could you just say your question again?
Okay. In terms of the need to run less gas for flexibility reserves, the emission impacts of that should be captured in production cost modeling.
I think the previous question was about additional investment, and my answer was regarding additional investment. It's true, we are simulating the reserve requirements under different scenarios differently, and part of the impact will be captured by the production cost simulation, but we are not doing a sub-hourly simulation, so some of the flexibility that might be reflected in the sub-hourly simulation will not be captured, but yes, you're right, on the hourly basis, we will be capturing potential impact.
I heard Carl's question starting out as with regard to operation of flexible resources. I may have been wrong there, but anyway, thank you.
Kevin, this is Arnie Olson. I would just encourage you also to keep in mind that the heat rate curves that these production simulation models have in them are highly simplified and aggregated, and that to the extent that you know, a broader and more diverse market would allow resources to operate with less ramping, less cycling, and at more for more time at closer to its most efficient set point. But there's a lot of that kind of stuff, you know, real life messiness, which, you know, is not at all captured in the model. And certainly there are fuel cost savings that aren't being captured, but I would think that even it would be even more so that the emissions are much higher when the units are operated in this way. So there's a big emission savings that's also not going to be captured in any of the modeling.
Okay.
Okay, Brewster. So Lauren, any questions before we move on? Anybody sneak in the queue?
No more questions.
Great. Okay.
Okay, this is Brewster again. I just would roll up our early material by making a short comment about the disadvantaged communities data that we're presenting. This is truly baseline information drawn from the CalEnviro screen model. We have some maps and some tables in the material that's posted on the website. And the key points of that, we're focusing on those census tracts, and yet we will be aggregating them by different overlays. But the aggregation will be counting up the census tracts that are within the top 25% of scores, as measured by the CalEnviro screen, and that definition is in harmony with California policy. So we're sticking to it. Just a note about some of the locations where you may expect, if you track this information, the counties with the highest percentages of disadvantaged communities are really going to be mainly Central Valley, Merced County, Tulare, Fresno, Kings, for example. And then when we're talking about the renewable resources build-out, when it is occurring in Westlands or the Central Valley Creses, we are likely to see an overlap of that build-out with environmental justice communities, or rather disadvantaged communities. So we'll be looking at the potential coincidence of the build-out with the disadvantaged communities, primarily to indicate the level of build-out and the potential of short-term construction-related effects. We absolutely recognize that that's not the whole story. That there are many other effects that go into the disadvantaged communities analysis, and so the whole story will really be a combination of the environmental as well as economic results. But these are the physical locations where the environmental study will spend a little bit of extra time focusing the discussion. And that concludes my presentation of this material.
Great, thank you, Brewster. So we do have a couple of minutes for questions. If you have any questions for any of the presenters today, before Debbie moves on to next steps. Like someone entered the queue. So Lauren, can you go ahead and open up the phone line? Just a reminder to identify yourself first, please.
Hi, this is Keith White, California staff. I have a California PhD staff. I have a really quick high-level question. The regional ISO cases reflect both modeled sort of operational and transactional changes. And they also include different infrastructure assumptions still in the ground, transmission and renewables. And I think, and it's, you know, it's plausible that those infrastructure changes could accompany the ISO expansion. But it would be really helpful to understand what aspects of the results, such as the cost savings, come from the operational change modeling versus adding the different infrastructure? And it sounded to me like maybe the case two and case three that were described briefly today might allow doing that, because it sounded like case two has the operational changes but not the infrastructure changes designed to reflect the expansion, and whereas case three has both. So would those two cases, their comparison of those two cases, make it possible to distinguish the effect of the operational benefits modeling versus the different infrastructure that's added under the expansion case?
Yeah, this is Deb Levine. That's correct.
Well, this is Arnie, Deb. But just a quick clarification to that is that, Keith, we do see a little bit of an adjustment in the portfolio in Scenario 2. The ability to export more and the ability to draw upon a larger set of resources to perform the integration services does make particularly the California solar a little bit more valuable in Scenario 2 than in Scenario 1. Also, there's less curtailment in Scenario 2. So there's a little bit of a steel underground change in Scenario 2 as well, but largely you can look at that as the effects of operations only.
Okay, thanks. I just think it would be valuable to everybody to get a feel for the, the projected effects of the operational versus the infrastructure change. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Lauren, we'll take the next question.
This is Sean Rowe for Modesto, Santa Clara, in Redding. It's a question for Bear. And it's a generic question, probably cost cuts, most scenarios where disposable income increases is part of the analysis. But the question is there any sensitivity considered in your analysis as to a response to housing costs? In that there's more disposable income, does that a percentage of it gets absorbed in increased housing costs rather than other sectors of the economy?
David?
David, are you still on the line? You could press start.
I'm still here. I'm sorry. No, I'm here. I'm sorry. Can you just repeat the question, please?
Yeah, certainly. A question just regarding the factor or analysis of more disposable income for ratepayers, citizens, based on lower energy costs. And is there an accounting or a sensitivity to or a response of the housing costs in reflection to that greater
income? Yeah, I didn't catch the real estate element. Yeah, we do not actually look at feedback into asset prices for households. That would be a long-term consequence. As you know, even electricity rates are capitalized into real estate values, but I'm sorry, we don't have a financial component. So that would reflect adjustments in real estate prices. And that's also true for enterprises, too. I mean, their rents can sometimes be subject to adjustment as a result of their energy costs, but we don't incorporate those.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lauren, are there any other questions? I don't see any hands raised. But...
I have one more.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express again, and just had another question. Arnie, you mentioned some of the projects, the transmission projects that you're modeling in Scenario 3. Do you have that cost information for those projects?
I don't have it at my fingertips, David. If it wasn't already posted in the pre-release materials, then it will definitely be posted before the April 27th workshop.
Yeah, Artie, I did look, and it wasn't posted before, and it'd be great to have that information, you know, as soon as you can make it available. I think it was discussed back in February 8th, and you weren't sure at that point, and it would be great to be able to review that information before we see the study results.
Okay, yeah, no, certainly, it must have been just an oversight that we didn't get that into the deck, but you know, we've just used the public information. I think I described the projects that we used as the proxies. And we just use the public information that's available for those projects. But certainly before the April 27th, you'll have access to that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, we'll go ahead and take the last question in the queue, and then we are going to wrap it up. So, Lauren, if you can open up the phone line of Meredith Jungheim.
Hi, this is Meredith Jungheim from the CPUC. I guess this question is for Aspen. I'm a little confused as to why your presentation today didn't mention or talk about the GHG analysis that you're conducting. I did read your technical study, which has a very brief description of how you're studying the greenhouse gas impacts of CAISO expansion, and but I was really hoping for more information, and I guess I'm surprised that you're not even mentioning it on the call today.
Forgive me. Certainly, the topic is of great and tremendous interest to, I'm sure, many stakeholders. And I don't think I'm being hyperbolic there. The treatment of greenhouse gas emissions results is going to really probably be handled by the various members of the study team. From Aspen's point of view, the study methodology is relatively brief. It points to the PSO model, which will provide the information that allows us to show the directly emitted GHG and absolute metric ton quantities within California.
And sorry, but no one presented about the PSO model today, did they? In detail, we didn't hear a description of that model. I know that there's a report on the website.
Yes, PSO is merely the name of the model we're using to conduct the production cost simulation, and the production cost simulation will reflect the estimated dispatch and therefore electricity generation from every power plant in the WECC. And that also comes with it the resulting emissions, including greenhouse gas emissions. That's why ultimately we will report under each simulation the greenhouse gas emissions for WECC. We will also do an accounting of the greenhouse gas emissions associated with California under each scenario.
So we is Brattle, not Aspen?
The results will be coming out of the production cost simulation. Jointly, the study team will be reporting those results.
Okay. I know that quite a few parties commented on how you were going to do this analysis, so you know, going back to what you presented first thing this morning, I don't remember you saying anything about, you know, your methodology for determining potential GHG increases or decreases from the expanded footprint.
Right. So I apologize for that. It's true. We probably should have included something that talks about the metrics we're reporting. One of the primary metrics is greenhouse gas emissions. So that will be reported in the results.
And the methodology for how those results will be calculated is explained in
The methodology is directly linked to the power production. So each power plant has an emissions rate associated with its power production. So it's different for a coal plant from a natural gas combined cycle and a natural gas turbine. And then when they are dispatched under different scenarios, there will be associated greenhouse gas emissions with each scenario. So we will be reporting those. Is that what?
Yeah, and again, I read the report on the PSO model, and I also read the Aspen report, and I didn't see an explanation of that beyond a few sentences in the Aspen report. So I was looking for more information. Thanks.
No, that's a good point. Thank you.
Okay. So let's move on to next steps because we are at the end of our call. So, Debbie?
Thank you. First, thank you, everyone, for today's discussion. I think it's been very helpful for us to hear what areas you're concerned with and the different comments on the way that we presented it. So we'll go ahead and make some adjustments for the April 27th, 28th stakeholder meeting. For that meeting, it will be here at the ISO. We will also have a WebEx available to the extent that you don't want to travel to Folsom for the 2 days. At this point in time, we plan on posting the materials for that stakeholder meeting on April the 25th. We have gotten some concerns were raised by a number of stakeholders on the original May 6th comment date that we had put into the market notice, so we have pushed out those comments. So comments will not be due to the ISO from the April 27th, 28th stakeholder meeting until May the 13th. We do have additional reference materials on the ISO website with respect to SB 315, 350, along with benefits, and as most of you have cross-referenced today, the 9 documents we put out on the early release materials. So with that, if anyone has any last-minute questions, we can take probably one or two. We're a little bit over 12.
Yeah, and just a reminder, if you do have a question following the call, you can submit that to the Regional Integrations at caiso.com mailbox. Also, just to let you know, we did record the call today. So if you weren't able to join the entire call, we will have that file posted on the Regional Energy Markets page sometime next week after we get it from AT&T. We'll post that and make it available to stakeholders. Or if you know of somebody who wasn't able to join us today and who's interested in listening, you know, they can definitely listen to that recording. So it looks like we do have a question in the queue, so Lauren will go ahead and take the question.
Hi, this is Kevin Woodruff, consultant for TURN. I'm looking at the slide here. Is there May 13 stakeholder comments due to ISO? Okay, that's fine. The extra week makes it manageable probably. What happens after that? Do you have a are you going to take stock after that? I know the ISO has a desire to have the SB 350 mandated sort of public meetings pretty quickly thereafter.
Yes, at this point, based on the pushing out of the comments, we're looking to release the final report in early June and hoping to have the multi-agency workshop before the end of June.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us. We do appreciate the comments. So if there are no other questions, we'll go ahead and conclude the call. Thank you to our speakers, and also thank you to AT&T.